What's your favorite recipe? When I was going off to live on my own at 30 or so, I was home shortly before that, and my mother, who really did not believe I could do that well on my own, chose that moment to give me two things. One was a lesson in how to do shirts, at the end of which she said, the main thing is never buy anything that isn't Stay Press. The other was a Betty Crocker recipe book, which I still have, and which over the years has stood me in good stead. What's your favorite recipe? Most of us have one, a set of steps that we go through to make something we really like, or that others like. We have recipes for the way we live, too, don't we? We have patterns that tell us how to do everything from weddings to funerals. When Jacqueline and I got married, we got married in the church that I was serving in Norwich, Connecticut. And we had our reception in the basement. It was a morning wedding. And afterwards, there was food there, and there was a cake in the very formal room that they had. And I don't know that we had really thought much beyond just getting married. We were pretty much done at the end of the service. That kiss, that was it. I was over. And so, but we were there. We'd been greeting people. And suddenly, some people came over and said, it's time for the song. We hadn't planned any song. We didn't know about any song. But apparently, in Eastern Connecticut, it is a recipe for weddings. It is a tradition that while you cut the cake, they sing this little song. The bride cuts the cake. The bride cuts the cake. I don't know the rest of the song. We didn't know anything about this song, but we knew about cutting the cake, and so Jacqueline was starting to cut the cake, and then everybody started singing this song, and they wanted us to sing along. We didn't know the song. We all have recipes. We have ways of doing things. You know how planning sessions usually start for events, right? What did we do last time? It's true everywhere, not just in churches. I like to think of these voices from the past as ghosts, telling us how to do things and what we should do. Sometimes that can be helpful, but the ghost can also blind us to new possibilities. Henrik Ibsen's play Ghost traces the downfall of an entire family because they are controlled and consumed by their history and their past. And it made me think this week about this question. Which way are you facing? Are you looking back to the recipes of the past, controlled by the ghosts, or facing forward in your own journey? Because we live in a time of change, and the only way to deal with change is to face forward and see how you walk in the midst of it. Jesus lived in a time of great economic change. For centuries, the villages of Galilee had functioned with very few poor people and very few rich people. The hillsides were terraced, and they were full of little farms. And in the villages, there were craftspeople. We find that all over the Mediterranean, there are crafts and things that were made in the Galilee. Jesus' father himself was a woodworker and probably made wooden tools. So we think of these little villages on the hillsides as places that are almost self-contained economies. But in Jesus' time and in the first century, that was all changing. Just as in the last century, rich people began to buy up small family farms in Kansas and other places, so in the Galilee, rich Romans had begun to buy up these small farms and either push people off or employ them as sharecroppers, no longer as owners. Now, these rich Romans, of course, they didn't want to live out in rural areas, and so they would hire someone called a steward or a manager. And the manager was in charge of the large farm, and the manager would make loans so that people could function on the farm. And the loans were written so that the interest was included. So when we read about a loan for 100 measures of oil, for example, about half of that is interest. Those interest rates were exorbitant. In fact, they were illegal, but they were charged nevertheless, and the steward was paid a commission. So the more the steward squeezed these sharecroppers, the more money the steward made. Now, when I think about this steward, I imagine him as someone who was living in the area already. Maybe he grew up on one of those small farms that's now part of the large, rich farm. And I wonder how happy he must have been when he got hired to be the steward. That made him a big man in a small town. But it certainly wouldn't have made him someone that people liked. He was the kind of guy that pushed deals, I'm sure bargained hard, didn't always do things fairly. Maybe he just stole. Nevertheless, I imagine at the beginning he must have been very joyful about getting this job. This is a good job in this area. And I imagine that he pursued it. And when people got hurt, I think of him saying what is always said. It's not personal, it's just business. We don't know what he did. Maybe he crossed some lines. Maybe he made a few shady deals. But there were complaints. And suddenly there's a crisis and an investigation, and he hears that he's about to be fired. Now imagine the night after he gets that message. Imagine it. Imagine his fears and his anxiety. Now the crisis isn't just business. Now it's him and it's personal. He considers the alternatives, rejecting them one by one. What will I do now? I'm not strong enough to dig. I'm ashamed to beg. Shame. Strength. These things limit his alternatives. But he has one thing going for him, doesn't he? He's a crafty guy. And now he uses the same financial manipulation and craft to get out of his dilemma. The change he makes is to put relationships first. His only hope is to create a situation where he will, as he says, be welcomed into the homes of people. So one by one, he calls them in. How much do you owe my master? 100 measures of oil. 900 gallons, that is. Sit down and write 50. Can you just imagine this? Can you imagine your bank calling you up and saying, we'd like to come in and have you discuss your mortgage? That's enough to make a bad day for anyone. But then imagine going in and having your landlord say, you know, I've decided to stop charging you rent. Or having your bank say, I've decided to cancel your mortgage, your home is yours free and clear. Imagine getting a letter from your credit card company that says, you have a zero balance. Congratulations, thanks for being our customer. Imagine the joy of these people. Imagine how stunned they were at this change. Change is like that sometimes. I wonder if they didn't believe it. Because who would, right? Who would believe this if you went in to the bank and they said, we're going to cancel your mortgage? What would be your first reaction? I know mine. It would be, really? Really? Because I tend to operate from an old recipe, and one of the old recipes is, if it sounds too good to be true, it isn't. I tend to operate from a recipe that says, oh, banks, they're always looking for a way to make a buck off of me. So if they're telling me this, there must be something in it for them. Would you look at it that way? See, I tend to face backward about all the times when I got bumped. It's hard to face forward. So I imagine that olive oil guy, I imagine him just sitting there. Write 50. Of course, now he's involved in the fraud, isn't he? You see that? But under the law, whatever the steward commits to, the master's committed to. So imagine him sitting there. Imagine him, you know, farmers are shrewd guys. And I imagine him sitting there trying to figure out, what is this guy's angle before he signs on to this? It's hard to face forward. It's hard to deal with that level of change. And it was hard for people to hear this story, too. Was it hard for you? I actually had a member who threatened to leave a church once after I read this story. This comes up in the lectionary about every 3 years. And we had an investment manager who read the story. And the next week he called me and he said he wanted to talk about this because he was planning to leave the church. If we were going to push this level of financial dishonesty, he didn't want to be any part of it. And I think that the early church had the same problems here. In verse 8, it says, because the story just ends, take your bill and write 80. In verse 8, in this text, it says the master commended this dishonest steward. Now, the word master in this text actually is Lord. It's the same word that's used over and over about Jesus. And what I think we're hearing here is the reaction of the very first disciples who are shocked that Jesus is commending this dishonest steward. Were you shocked? Can Jesus still shock you? I think they're surprised and shocked. The master commended this guy, and already, before Luke ever puts this parable into his gospel, already the church has written all these different interpretations that I read, and you can go back and read again. And if you look at them carefully, some of them actually contradict the parable because people were so shocked by this. Shocking. Shocking when Jesus yanks us into facing forward. But that's what he does over and over again. The crisis of discipleship can't be met with old recipes. We see it all over the preaching of Jesus. Forgive, he says. Well, what is forgiveness but letting go of the past? Old ghosts who whisper about old hurts, old resentments, old fears. In the ultimate moment at the Last Supper, he reminds them of Jeremiah's vision of a new covenant, not like the old covenant. And his whole life and death and resurrection are meant to show God breaking through in a new way, to face forward into God's future. It's hard to let go of recipes. It's hard to try something new, isn't it? I went to see the movie Scully recently. It's a simple story about a 208-second long flight. It began as an ordinary trip out of LaGuardia to Charlottesville, Virginia. And, you know, I fly enough that I can just imagine how this went. I can imagine the people standing around. I can imagine them getting on the plane and finding their seats, putting their luggage up, and some of them tucking it under their seat. I can imagine the flight attendants. I almost know by heart what the flight attendants say. Please buckle your seatbelt securely. And then the door has been closed. We are cleared for takeoff. All cell phones must be turned off or placed in the airline position. So the aircraft backs away from the terminal. It taxis into position, just like any flight. The pilots are given clearance, and there is that exhilarating moment when suddenly you're rushing down the runway and jumping into the air in a moment that still seems magical to me. And it seemed magical for 3 minutes. Because at the 3-minute mark, that plane flew through a flock of birds and the engines were destroyed. Now, passenger airliners are called by the tower heavies, and the reason is they don't glide that well. Captain Sulzberger, the pilot, announced almost immediately that he was going to do what the recipe said. What the recipe said was turn around, go back to LaGuardia. So he set out to do that. But almost instantly, he recognized that because of the tall buildings in New York and all of the things in the way, he wasn't going to be able to make it. The amazing thing about this story is that this man was able instantly to let go of the recipe and go with another possibility, to face forward and decide to land in the Hudson River. Now, all pilots know that water landings are enormously difficult. And how much more so in a river like the Hudson? And yet, the pilot was able to land the plane. The flight attendants were able to get everyone off of the plane. 155 lives were saved. The movie focuses on a long investigation determined to show that the pilot made the wrong choice, that he should have followed the recipe. What they ultimately discover is that if he had, the plane likely would have been lost. On the way is the most frequent comment about Jesus. On the way means facing forward into the future. That's what the pilot did on that flight. That's what Jesus calls us to do. It's more important than the exact tactics, as he shows in the parable. Every day brings occasions that ask whether we're just going to follow recipes or face forward and find new answers. I wonder what blessings you could plant facing forward. I wonder, because Jesus mentioned that even a small seed, a tiny one like a mustard seed, might just grow in a huge and unexpected way. It might have an effect that we never imagined, that only God had in mind from the very beginning. Amen. Amen.